Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Campus Conservative. My name is Robert Sasso. I hope everyone has settled into the fall semester well. Today, we have a very special guest, former chairman of YAF at the University of Kansas, Senate GOP policy alum, speak freely, power moves only, retweets are not endorsements, time is fair. Gabriel Lipinski, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Fantastic, Robert. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Today, we have a fun agenda. We'll start off with international affairs as they stand today, religious liberty in the Trump era, Obamacare and its future. Let's get started. So with international affairs, we know since Trump's taken over, the world's been a crazy place. And one place where it has never ceased to amaze us is North Korea. Our friends over there, Kim Jong-un, better known as Rocket Man, to the president, has caused a lot of problems since Trump's taken office. And not a lot of people are happy about the way he's handled it. So to start off, Gabe, what do you think's going on with North Korea? Should we be planning for a nuclear strike, getting a bunker, or is this all hubbub?
Well, you know, one thing that we've got to consider with North Korea, Robert, is that North Korea has been all hubbub for the last, 20 or 30 years. Obviously, they've made strides in increasing their nuclear and missile capabilities. But all in all, it's just been a war of words and propaganda for the North Korean people. I do think that the threat level, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of how they're advancing their missile and nuclear technology, does pose a significant threat, not necessarily to the U.S. right now, but to, its neighbors like Japan and South Korea. Ultimately, I do think that something is going to have to happen, whether it be severe diplomatic, restraints on North Korea, or military action. However, one thing that I would commend Trump on, I am awfully critical of the president just because I'm a stickler when it comes to foreign policy, but people forget Donald Trump was instrumental in getting record sanctions on North Korea just this past year without the veto of China or Russia, which is something that almost no president has been able to get in the past. So I think that we've got to do a good job of commending Trump for where he's been able to succeed. And when it comes to North Korea, you've kind of got to take what you can get until we reach sort of that critical level where it is going to require either a military or extreme diplomatic solution.
I think when it comes to Trump, like you said, I'm also very critical of President Trump. I think one place, I don't think it's just really because he was his candidacy in that sense made it that way, but everyone was really worried about foreign policy. They always said, oh, Trump's going to be the guy to just nuke someone at random or just send out a tweet about going to war. And I think that it was kind of just like kind of the meme of Trump, like, oh, he's this crazy Twitter fool who's going to do something irrational. But I think he's been very good on foreign policy because we can't forget that not so long ago, Otto Warmbier was able to come back, unfortunately die, but die in America, where the Obama administration basically told the parents that there was nothing they could do. And Trump was able to get him out with the help of Rex Tillerson. And staying on that same note, Rex Tillerson received a tweet from Donald Trump on the 1st saying, Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he's wasting time trying to negotiate with little Rocket Man. Save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done. Gabe, should I be worried about this tweet, or is this kind of just Trump telling the world that he's going to find his own diplomatic solution?
Well, I don't think that in general we should take the president's tweets too seriously. Oftentimes, I think that Trump legitimately is a guy who likes to say stuff and he says what's on his mind. Whether or not that's correct or not, I mean, we could sit here and argue all day. At the end of the day, I think that we've got to separate Trump's policy decisions from his Twitter account, because as we saw in the past, Trump has tweeted out, things that were, highly politically charged, like we're going to ban transgenders from entering the military. And ultimately, we haven't seen that go into effect. So especially when it comes to, high tension situations like North Korea, I don't think that we should be as worried about Trump's Twitter account as I think the mainstream media is leading us to believe. Is it helpful? Maybe not. Probably not. Actually, definitely not. But ultimately, I think that we need to focus on Trump's policy towards North Korea rather than his tweets at the Secretary of State about how they're going to handle North Korea. I think that's no different than you would see in, a Trump UN speech, where everything that he said sounded good, but I want to see it put into policy. And everything bad that he might say on Twitter, I think that we should take it with a grain of salt as well until we see it put in policy.
Now, going back to what you said earlier, and you look at the UN speech and you look at the sanctions, his work with the UN in conjunction with other Security Council countries in sanctioning North Korea has been successful. But one of the downsides to these sanctions are not that they aren't implemented as strongly as we hope, but the fact that when they do get implemented, it may cause North Korea to become even more irrational. My reason for that is when you're cutting off their oil, which is cutting off their money and cutting off their food supply, it's going to force Kim Jong-un to do one of two things. I think he can either go to the discussions with other countries and say, listen, we'll back down. We need food. We need to make sure our country's going to be able to survive without a revolt. Or Kim Jong-un's going to say, basically, screw it. You know, I have nothing left to lose. Let's just attack Guam, attack Hawaii, or attack California. And he just fires a nuke, even if he's not even ready. And it could hit a country that he wasn't even planning on doing. Do you think that this is a valid concern that North Korea can actually be hypercharged by this and actually go closer to launching a nuclear strike? Or is this actually a progressive forward movement and that we're going to really get North Korea here by getting them to pony up to the sanctions and come to the decision table?
You know, that's an excellent point, Robert, and it's one that a lot of people within the realm of foreign policy have brought up over and over again. How much do we truly know about the cause and effect between what the U.S. and the international community does and how North Korea is going to react? Ultimately, as unfortunate as it is, I think that you have to play things like this by ear. That's not ideal, but you can't sit back and let North Korea run roughshod over, you know, the over the Asian. Sorry, over the Asian or over the Korean Peninsula and the greater Asian territory in general. You've seen that with Iran, which we're going to get into later. As soon as you give regimes like this an inch, they'll take a mile. So while these sanctions might send North Korea in the wrong direction, ultimately it's the role of the U.S. and the international community as a whole to hold North Korea to a standard that it would, you know, any other country. It doesn't matter how, you know, insane their leader might be. Ultimately, it's the job of the U.S. and the international community to keep rogue regimes like these in check. And one way to do that without, you know, sending in, you know, troops or resorting to, you know, military action is through sanctions. As soon as we send in, you know, any sort of military action or any sort of troops, then there's really no telling what North Korea might do, especially, you know, as well equipped as they're becoming. I think that the right route is to keep pursuing sanctions. And like I said, you know, it's just our job and the international community's job to keep North Korea in check. We can't, be skeptical about what might happen tomorrow, because ultimately we need to keep the regime in check today. And that's not punting the football farther down the road, but that's doing what we can with North Korea and the security situation in the Korean Peninsula and Asian as a whole, or in Asia as a whole today.
I really like that answer. I think if I knew nothing and you were kind of just making that pitch to me, I think I would buy it. I think that sanctions would sound really good from what you're saying, because I think people don't understand. Going back to what I actually know personally, it's just sanctions are very good to use for these countries because people don't understand the power of the economy. The economy works in the back room. It's not a very sexy political topic. It's not something people like to look into because it's a lot of numbers, but it works. Hurting people's economies gets them to work because if the money's not flowing, they're not popular. And just going back to what you said about the Korean Peninsula, I mean, you have to imagine that we can't really get too militarily involved with North Korea, because when you look at Seoul, the capital of South Korea, that's 10 million people in the city, just under 9.86 is the actual total, 9.68 million. That's a lot of people that would die if they were to strike. So we actually have to be very smart here. It's not like we're playing with house money. We have to make sure that we get the strongest solution out there, because Kim Jong-un will act irrationally. We've seen how he's killed his brother and he's led to the death of Otto Warmbier. So we have to be careful. But like you said, we're moving on to the Iran deal. And I got ahead of myself, Iran. But when you look at the Iran deal, which was structured by Obama in the sense that he looked at the North Korea nuclear deal back in the 90s with Bill Clinton, does it worry you that 10 or 15 years down the line, we're dealing with the same problem, except with a country in the Middle East, which is a lot more hotbed of a political zone and even more dangerous because they have stated that they want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth?
Absolutely. And that's a great point that you bring up about how the Iran deal was modeled by Ben Rhodes and Barack Obama when they drew it up. it wasn't something that they just pulled out of midair. It was structured around the original deal that Bill Clinton made with North Korea. As soon as that deal with Iran was complete, we've seen an influx of literally pallets of cash into Iran. And Iran is not spending that on social welfare programs or, you know, any sort of economic reforms. Instead, they're funneling it to, you know, terrorist groups such as Hezbollah, Hamas, basically funneling that money to anyone who will, you know, further more destabilization within the Middle East, because ultimately that helps Iran. You know, I feel like people have sort of this misguided perception of Iran that it might be a weak state. Iran is actually probably the strongest state outside of Israel within the Middle East in terms of, you know, economic and military might, certainly since, you know, the downfall of the Iraqi military under Saddam Hussein. And Iran functions pretty well under the chaos that it's starting to create as a result of this influx of cash. And you haven't seen them slow their nuclear deal. You're seeing more and more aggressive, you know, missile tests and, you know, more and more pouring in of money into, you know, military supplies and things like and things of that nature, you know, buying jets from Russia. This is a bad deal for the United States, and it show and North Korea is a great case study of where Iran could be leading themselves down the road to in the future. That's a great point that you brought up about the North Korea deal. Not many people know that that served as sort of the framework of how the Obama administration and Ben Rhodes were going to approach the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, that was something I picked up when listening to Mark Levin around inauguration time. And I think that was very interesting to me because, like you said, it's a case study. And history, I mean, it might not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And when you look at deals like this, Iran is even worse because of the relations we have with them. They've been so bad since 1979, even 1953, if you look back to the overthrowing of the Shah back then. But it's been tough there. And the oil they have, when you saw what happened when the sanctions went off and the oil prices changed a lot in 2015, 2016, there's a lot of chaos, like you said, that comes from Iran. And I think it's something that we shouldn't be fearful in the sense that our lives are at stake, but we should be fearful in the sense that it's going to create a lot of destabilization in the world. And I think you mentioned that pretty well in your little discussion right there. And I think that people don't understand that when you make these decisions on the foreign policy front, it's very difficult to get them back, especially when administrations change and the deals have to stay the same. I think as you wanted to talk about international affairs, it's very difficult to maneuver the world when there's so much chaos in it. Do you think that Iran is benefiting from any help, maybe even Russia? I know that there's a lot of nefarious actors in the world. Is Vladimir Putin one of them?
Is Vladimir Putin one of the bad actors in the world?
Is Vladimir helping out with Iran? Is he helping this destabilization of the region? Is he going to influence Iran to act in a certain way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we would be fools to pretend like he doesn't. I mean, Russia, just like Iran, craves the sort of chaos that we're seeing within the Middle East. No one is benefiting more from the dragging civil war within Syria than Iran and Russia. Even though they back Bashar al-Assad, who likely will one day fall out of power just because of the way that the Syrian civil war is going, they crave the sort of chaos. They thrive on the instability of the Middle East, because as long as there's this huge refugee problem influxing into the West, which helps Russia, and this huge destabilization of, you know, a major country within the Middle East, that's Syria, Iran's going to see that and think, all right, this is our time to move. There's chaos within the region. What can we do to further solidify our foothold within this region and establish ourselves as the number one power within the region, both in terms of, you know, military capabilities, economic capabilities, all of that. Russia and Iran absolutely thrive on this chaos, and they sort of play off each other. Like I said, Russia has been willingly selling arms to Iran, you know, since the nuclear deal and even before the nuclear deal has been passed. Russia has even launched a couple of airstrikes from Iranian air bases, which once found out, Russia had to walk back. So they are definitely working with each other to sort of not encourage this sort of instability, but certainly foster, you know, a cloud of doubt within the, you know, American populace and the American government about where the Middle East is going. I think that we cannot overstate the relationship between Russia and Iran when it comes to, you know, chaos within the Middle East, and how much they're able to benefit from it.
Definitely. I think when it comes to Vladimir Putin, I think he's viewed differently as a nefarious actor as maybe Bashar al-Assad is. I don't think he's one of those actors where everyone could say, oh, we disavow of Vladimir Putin, because he has become a politically charged candidate person in America because of what happened in the 2016 election. I think that people don't understand that we all have to kind of rally around working against Russia, because Russia is going to act in their own interest, and chaos is their interest around the world. That I remember listening to a podcast on Planet Money where they basically discussed how they injected fake news stories, actual fake news stories, into Ukraine to draw up civil unrest. It's very, very nefarious what they're doing. So I think that's a great place to leave off on this topic. I think it's something that everyone should think about, especially with it being so relevant in our news cycle, especially with North Korea and Iran's kind of on the back burner now. But it's something to keep your eye on. It's something that you know very well. It's something that I think everyone here should really take seriously when listening to this section of the podcast, because I think that it was very well spoken on your part, and I think that it was a good place to leave. And now we're going to go to religious liberty in the Trump era. I know that religious liberty is always a very sensitive topic when it comes to discussing politics, because everyone has their own view of religion and what they think its role should be in society. And I think that one thing Trump has done, he's assured a lot of evangelicals who maybe weren't too happy with his presidency that he was going to nominate an originalist to the Supreme Court. And that originalist goes by the name of Neil Gorsuch. And I think that he's a very good pick by President Trump. I think it's one of his best moves so far. And one thing that you mentioned to me is that he actually ruled on a religious liberty case. Do you care to explain on that?
Yes, actually, Neil Gorsuch ruled on a either Masterpiece Cake Shop or something very similar to it when he was on the Court of Appeals in Colorado, where he basically said that if you force, you know, a religious baker to bake, you know, a wedding cake for a gay couple, or, you know, even go so far as to say that you are required to engage in the ceremony, you know, at the wedding with the cake, which is what Masterpiece Cake Shop is sort of pursuing in their Supreme Court case, that violates, you know, any religious liberty that we, you know, could conceive of in America. Because religious liberty, it does. Religious liberty requires that we are able to act on our religious beliefs. I'm a very secular fellow, you know. There's an idea, I think, on the left and growing within the Democratic Party that religious liberty should only expand to, this is what I think and I'm allowed to think it. I mean, obviously that should be the case. But more importantly, religious liberty is the idea that you can act on those beliefs and put them, you know, into the way that you go about your life. Because with, you know, without that opportunity granted to you by our Constitution and, you know, the religious liberty that we're supposed to have, then religious liberty, as the founders envisioned it and as it should be in the modern day, is gone.
I think religious liberty is definitely tough, because the area of the country I come from, very liberal Democrat area of the country, North New England. And I think one thing you don't really see as much when it comes to gun rights and religious liberty is that it's not as stressed as it is maybe in the middle of the country. And I think that it's definitely something I don't really get to see a lot. It's something that I don't get to experience. But there are those cases where people, like you said, with the religious baker, I mean, he should be able to make a decision. I mean, it's a dirty word in politics, but yes, he should be able to discriminate. I think it's a broader conversation. I don't really want to get into it with discrimination, but I think people should be able to work with and provide services for whoever they choose to. And I think that is what people don't realize, is that the government's job shouldn't be to come in and say you have to work with someone. It should be the free market's job to regulate who's successful. And I think that if people don't like someone who is selecting who they're making cakes for based on their religion or their sexual orientation, that you can go to the next maker who will. And I think that's what the free market does. I think that's what should happen with racial discrimination. People shouldn't be prevented from doing it by the government. People should be allowed to do it. And then when they do it, the government can come in. I mean, and the free market can come in and people can say, oh, I don't want to do work with racists. I don't want to receive services from racists. I'll go to the next guy. And that guy goes out of business. I think that's the beauty of this country. But unfortunately, that spirit of individualism and freedom and independence is kind of going away. Do you think that Trump can help revive a sense of religiosity in America? Not in the sense that everyone starts going to church more, but everyone starts being more respectful of religious people, people who choose to live a religious lifestyle?
You know, I think that, you know, President Trump certainly has an opportunity to do this. I really like the position that you brought up where, you know, we need to have this sort of free will with anyone who's conducting a business, you know, on anything. I'm very much libertarian like yourself when it comes to, you know, businesses deciding who to provide services to and who not to. I think that Austin Peterson actually has a great argument when it comes to this. Is would you make, you know, a Nazi or a Jewish baker bake a Nazi wedding cake? You know, obviously the Jewish baker should not be required to do that. This is not to put, you know, homosexuals on the same, you know, playing field as Nazis. Obviously that would be ridiculous, but it presents the idea that people should be able to discriminate against, you know, whoever might walk into their business, you know, for valid reasons. And even if, you know, you might disagree with the Nazi cake, you should still have to ask, you know, the question, why are you discriminating? Why? You should keep getting down to the fundamental issues of why people would discriminate in a business. If it comes down to, you know, sort of, this is what I believe, this is, you know, a part of my faith, which, as I explained earlier, you know, your faith is an extreme part of who you are. And I think that that's very important when we talk about this kind of stuff. I think that Trump absolutely has an opportunity to revive the religiosity that we, you know, at a certain point in this country, we used to be able to, you know, respect the, even though we might have disagreed with, you know, religious people, we were able to respect their beliefs and, you know, understand why they were making the decisions that we do. I think that, you know, President Trump, especially, you know, having the sort of opportunity to engage in the culture that he does as president, really has to seize this moment and make it one for religious liberty where, you know, again, we don't have to necessarily agree on whether, you know, on, you know, all biblical issues or, you know, all religious, you know, ideas, but understand where people are coming from when they act on behalf of their religious beliefs and why it's important to maintain religious liberty so that they can act on those religious beliefs.
Yeah, I think religious beliefs are definitely a tough issue in America because I think that as we get more secular as a culture, people, they don't want to engage in that lifestyle. I think that people who are religious are bigoted in a sense. They think that people who are religious are dogmatic. Like Senator Feinstein said to a nominee for a judicial spot, the dogma lives deeply or strongly within you. I actually laughed. I'm what is the point in that? I mean, you're insulting this woman for her religious beliefs. Not only that, culturally being rude, it's actually arguable unconstitutional because you're giving a religious test to her, basically asking how her religion is going to affect her viewpoints on the Supreme Court or the appellate court. And I think that if you subbed her out with a devout Muslim woman, I think the reaction would have been a little bit more different. And I think that the intellectual inconsistency from the left when it comes to religion is very, very stark when it comes to this topic in particular, because they get very, very militantly angry against religious people. Do you think the left's reaction against religious people is actually building the case to be more religious in the sense that you're either siding with the people who want to tear down people who support these institutions, or is it just kind of going to be people are going to side with them and just say, religion is probably not that good?
Well, I think more than anything, I think that the left has sort of not necessarily driven people to be more religious, but I think that this should be considered a warning shot to those of us who might not necessarily be that religious, but really respect the First Amendment and, you know, sort of this free will attitude that everyone in America should possess. You know, I've got, you know, friends who are extremely religious who, you know, are worried that sooner or later their, you know, church is going to be, you know, have their door knocked on by the federal government and say, you know, you need to, you know, marry this gay couple. That should, I mean, the fact that that's entering the minds of some religious people should give us sort of, you know, that should be a catalyst for us, not necessarily super religious folk, but people who understand religious liberty and how important it is, come to the defense of those, you know, who, again, we might not agree with, but who we believe should have this ability to sort of, you know, act on their own religious accord. So I do think that the left is pursuing a losing issue on the religious liberty value. And when it comes to, you know, the far radical left, their religion is politics, and that is, and more importantly, their main religion is government. And government is the, you know, scariest word in all of the American language to conservatives. We need less of it, less alone have it be our religion. So I do think that the left is choosing a losing issue and definitely driving, you know, even people who might not be that religious into sort of the defense or the corner for defending, you know, religious people and their liberties. So like I said, that's a great question. Absolutely, the left has chosen a losing battle on their religious liberties.
We see a lot of losing battles from the left, and I think you put it perfect with the way that you said that religion is government to them. And I think that's a huge contrast when you look at the left and the right. The left, which tends to obviously, like you said, be more secular, worship government, they're a lot angrier all the time. They're always protesting something. There's always some cause that they need to be championing. There's always some group they need to be yelling at. And when you look at the people on the right and the more religious people, they're always finding a cause to get involved with when it comes to like charity or giving back in some sorts. And it's a lot more happy. I mean, being on the right side of the aisle, I mean, politics obviously is going to be tough. People are going to get mad about their politics. But in general, they're a lot happier. You see people who are sharing stories outside of politics. They're engaging in more cultural stuff. It just seems to be all around more sane to be on the right. And I think that it's just something that everyone needs to look at, because it's a contrast you do see if you sit down for more than 2 seconds and look at it, that the left is crazy. But there's also one thing I want to talk about with religion. It's not as much liberty, but it's actually something that culturally I'd like you to comment on. Average marriage age for women is up, and men, it's up a lot since 1960. And today, it's average age of marriage for women is 27, average age of men is 29. That's up from 20 for women and 23 for men in 1960. That's crazy numbers. And when you look at people who are unmarried at the age of 40, with the baby boomers, it's 91%. And Gen Xers, it's down to 82%. People are getting married less. People are getting married later. Is this a problem in American society, or is this just something that the right wing is just blabbing about for no reason?
You know, I do think that it is it's a growing problem within American society. I think just to go back on something that you talked about, you know, between the left and the right in culture is, you know, at least on the right, you know, I can argue with, you know, lone conservative founder Cassie Dillon, you know, about the merits of Trump's tweeting all day. But at the end of the day, we can come back and, you know, agree that, you know, we should have, you know, the same culture throughout America, and we can have a lot of the same cultural discussions that I wouldn't be able to have with, you know, in terms of someone on the left. And I think that plays a role in what you're talking about when it comes to, you know, the average age of marriage, you know, rising significantly, and even the rate that people are getting married at, you know, going down significantly. I'm actually taking a really interesting politics of identity class here at KU, even though I despise identity politics, that, you know, has examined the impact that, you know, being single has on, you know, those that it has on your engagement in politics, whether or not you're married or single, and, you know, how much more likely you are to share a likewise culture, you know, with your peers. And the numbers are astounding. Like, it's absolutely crazy. Those who, you know, are single are much less likely to be engaged in politics and much less likely to engage in a common culture than those who get married. And, you know, those who get married are much more likely to, you know, be culturally engaged in, you know, church, to be more culturally engaged in their community, more likely to, you know, be on, you know, the PTO or, you know, run for local offices or get involved in their community. So I do think that there's a huge cultural gap there between the left and the right, specifically what you're talking about with marriage, because we see in the numbers that you're more likely to be ostracized from our, you know, culture or feel disconnected from it if you are single. And I think that the assault that the left has done on religion and, you know, marriage itself has created this cultural divide where we're starting to lose it, because, I mean, people are starting to associate religion with marriage, which they should. And as soon as the left attacks religion, it's ultimately going to extend to, you know, marriage and the common, you know, culture that we have in common, when you know, we're talking about marriage and how much more likely you are to engage in that common culture when you are married as opposed to single.
Definitely. I think that's a great way you framed it. I like that when you said that it's, when you look at religion, you think of marriage and people attack marriage because it's part of religion. I think that's something very wary people should consider, because when, if marriage as an institution falls in the United States, I mean, people are going to replace it with something else and it's not going to be good. And I think that marriage has done a lot of good for America. And I think that it's something that no one should really put aside or trivialize. It's definitely something that everyone should take seriously, especially at our age, when within the next decade, hopefully, you can get married. And I mean, it's crazy to think about at our age, but yeah, it's that part of life and people are really skirting their responsibilities. And I think that religious liberty is a great topic to discuss with anyone. I think that we're going to leave off on a good spot there, and we're going to move on to our final topic. Our final topic is good old Obamacare. We love just saying that word. We love talking about it because for 8 years it has not gone away, and for 8 years we've been promised one thing and we've been given another. Before I go on any further, Gabe, since January 21st, how has your view on the administration's work for Obamacare been?
In terms of the administration's work, you know, there's no question that, you know, Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump are dealing with a divided Republican caucus within the House and Senate. And it's going to make it tough to, you know, get a bill done that everyone's going to be happy with. Ultimately, what I would like to see more, I really enjoyed or really supported the Graham Cassidy bill that we just saw, specifically as it had to do with, you know, the individual mandate, which is the funding mechanism for Obamacare, as we all know. I really would like to see the administration pursue more of that and decreasing the regulations. I think that President Trump, there's been rumors that he might issue an executive order to allow people to purchase outside of the state lines that they're in. And that's a huge win for those of us who want to see Obamacare at the very least massively reformed and ideally totally repealed. As soon as you remove those state lines, you create competition in the market, which is what Obamacare has, you know, led to the implosion of. There's hardly any competition anywhere. You know, my father and myself, you know, when I'm on break from school, I go home to Illinois. We've had our insurers cut in half in terms of who we can buy from on Obamacare exchanges. As soon as you drop those state lines, you create the competition necessary to get more insurers involved in the state markets. As soon as you do that, you've got people competing, you know, for the lowest price in healthcare. So I think that an executive order by President Trump to do exactly that, bring down the state lines, would be a very welcome development in the healthcare battle. And then, like you said, in terms of legislation, I would really like him to continue pursuing something like a Graham Cassidy bill.
Yeah, I think when it comes to one thing I want to focus on first is that you mentioned insurers. I think that's huge because when you look at the debate that happened between Bernie and Ted Cruz, which I think Ted Cruz did a masterful job on with Obamacare, he showed a map basically of all the counties in the country that have one insurer. And when you look at the counties, I mean, some whole states are red, red being the color of one insurer, the map I'm looking at. And a lot of these red areas, they're in those Rust Belt states that flip for Trump. And people don't realize that Trump is going to have to do something on this, not just because he promised it, but because people actually need this change. And people want to see change. And one thing that you mentioned that I really like is that competition is what's going to drive down prices. Obama had this fiction of economics that if you just create universality, you throw people onto exchanges, you make people who don't need a Cadillac plan buy a Cadillac plan, one of those premium plans that just cover female health, female reproduction health for guys. It's just ridiculous stories you hear from this. Make them pay for these plans. It's going to create cheaper prices for everyone. And it's not. It's just going to raise prices. It's going to bankrupt insurance companies because insurance is a bet. Insurance is betting, you betting that you're going to pay in for healthcare coverage because you're going to need it one day. And the insurer is betting on you not getting sick. And if you are a very healthy person, that risk is low. So your price, your premium will be low. But if you smoke, if you have a pre-existing condition, if you have anything, your risk is going to be high. I mean, nothing I'm saying is anything controversial to an economist. But if you talk to anyone on the left, especially Bernie Sanders, who definitely didn't take economics 101 at Brooklyn College. What I'm saying is heresy, and I'm being racist or something. Do you think that Trump is making this pitch that I just made to the people about healthcare, or is he kind of just sitting in the back, kind of wheeling and dealing, hopefully that this bill is going to work out for him?
Well, ultimately, I do think that President Trump, especially, you know, with the way that the tenacity that he's gone after Republican leadership before, I would like to see it channeled into a more constructive, method to get people to start voting, you know, to actually get rid of some of, you know, Obamacare's like big mandates. One unpopular thing, and I think that as soon as conservatives lost this talking point that I'm about to bring up, we lost the debate on healthcare, is pre-existing conditions. What I think Donald Trump has to do, or President Trump, pardon me, has to do is go out and make the pitch for why pre-existing conditions cannot be covered by insurance. You know, you hear it all the time on, you know, any conservative podcast that you or I might listen to, is that you can't go out and buy fire insurance, you know, once your house burns down, because then there's no funding mechanism, you know, for insurance, and there's no incentive for insurance companies to get involved in the game. They need to make money in order for you to get good health insurance. It's not an either or game. We depend on insurance companies, you know, to sort of require us to buy this health insurance before, you know, the house burns down. Otherwise, there's no funding. And ultimately, you know, the way that I always like to phrase it is this, and I think this is the way that President Trump should frame it. You can either cover or you can either not cover pre-existing conditions. Otherwise, it's not healthcare anymore. It's a welfare program. And we can debate welfare programs, you know, all day and the merits of them. But I'm really tired of the left framing it as healthcare as soon as you cover, you know, pre-existing conditions, because that's just not what it is. And I think that if President Trump took that argument to the American people and explained why the healthcare markets have to function this way, it could be a real winning issue for Republicans. And I don't think it's one that they've focused on enough.
Yeah, I think pre-existing conditions is the hardest, because I know last year we had a roundtable discussion. Our Speech and Debate Society hosts this every year, basically allowing everyone to come and just discuss politics. And when we got to last topic was religion. When we got to insurance, a big thing was pre-existing conditions. The liberals hit me on that. They wanted me to basically explain myself on pre-existing conditions, because like you said, the way they frame the debate, they make pre-existing conditions very hard to debate. I know this is a Joseph Stalin quote, but it applies here perfectly, and it's funny how the left uses it. He said, "A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic." So why that matters is because if you throw up little Timmy who has cancer or has a disease that Obamacare has helped him get covered, people gravitate towards that. People say, oh, we need Obamacare because of this. But what you don't see are the millions and millions of families getting thrown off their insurance programs because A, they don't have insurers, or B, they can't afford it. And it's hard for the right to frame that in the sense that, oh, we have these 6 million people over here. But the left says, oh, we have little Timmy over here who needs the coverage. Who's going to win at the end of the day? And it's going to be the firepower of using those victims. The left loves victimhood, and you know this very well. Left loves victimhood, and they're going to use it whenever they can. So, like you said, it's important that the right needs to start framing the debate, especially Donald Trump. He needs to turn people's heads on pre-existing conditions, because it's a very hard point to argue, but there's a lot of reading on it you can do, and there's a lot of videos you can watch on it, because pre-existing conditions need to be argued very finely, because it's an issue you can win. It's a very distinct argument, but you definitely can make it, and I know I've made it. I don't know if you've made it ever against in a debate or something, but it's definitely a really good argument, because people will gravitate towards it if you make it correctly. So with that being said, healthcare is a topic that the Democrats have seized on. It's something that in 2008, it was crazy to see that Obama and Clinton were running so heavily on universal healthcare, something that they couldn't get passed in the Clinton administration. It looks like in 2020, every Democrat running is going to at least support Medicare for all. Why are the Democrats so radical on healthcare?
Oh, boy. You know, wow. That's a great question, Robert. I think that the Democrats have become increasingly more radical on healthcare, kind of to get back to what we said earlier. I mean, when there are cracks in, you know, the healthcare system back before Obamacare, Republicans relied on, you know, charity, because, you know, religion plays a huge role, I think, statistics show, in, you know, the rights lives and, you know, the way that we contribute to charity and the way that we view community. But as soon as, you know, government is your religion, oh, I just need, you know, more of it. I think that Ted Cruz, one of the more, you know, hilarious, but, you know, good points that I've seen made about healthcare is that, you know, Bernie and the Democrats just keep yelling, more cowbell, more cowbell. We need more cowbell. You know, I think that Democrats really don't think that their position on healthcare is that radical. They really do see government as the end all be all. And you saw that actually specifically. This, you know, reminds me of a Chris Murphy tweet from Connecticut after, you know, the failure of skinny repeal by Republicans. Chris Murphy tweeted out, you know, tonight shows that there's nothing that can't be done politically to help save your life. And that is, or something to that effect. And that was one of the more alarming tweets that I think I have ever seen. Because again, it gets back to this idea of, you know, the government being your religion. And as soon as the government is your religion, you know, you keep looking to your religion why things are going wrong. And, you know, if you just think that you need more cowbell, you're going to keep increasing the government, which is why all these Democrats have ended up arguing seemingly, you know, out of nowhere. I thought Obamacare was working fine from what they told me 5 minutes ago. But now you're seeing them trot out these 2020, you know, promises of Medicare for all because they truly believe that they just need more cowbell and they just need more government because at this point it's become the left religion.
Yes, I think religion and leftism are one and the same. I think that healthcare is very difficult to debate because people have this idea that universal healthcare is the best healthcare, but it's not. Dan McLaughlin, he has a great tweet out that I really like citing when it comes to talking about healthcare. It's five words. Universal, affordable, quality. Pick two. It's that simple. If it's universal and affordable, it's not going to be quality. That's definitely when you look at the communist models like Cuba. It's universal. Everyone has it. It's very cheap, but you don't have bedpans. You don't have basic saline, basic that stuff. You go to a hospital, it's barren if you are not a party member. Universal and quality, that's like the NHS, even though it's not really even that quality. And you look at Canada, it's not even that quality, even though they go for the universal and quality model, because it just blows out their spending and it's universal. So people work slower because it's all government bureaucrats. And then you get stories like Charlie Gard. America, which is drifting away from this, but aims to be affordable and quality, because in a market economy, not everyone is going to be covered. Universality isn't possible. That's where, like you said, charity and religion are there to fill the gaps. Americans are extremely generous. St. Jude's is a charity hospital. You look at, I don't know the name of the one out west, but there's a lot of charity hospitals. Americans are very rich compared to the whole world, and they're very generous compared to the whole world. People will give charity for other sick people if the government won't step in. And people don't realize that. That's what I want to ask you now. How can we convince people that charity is more thoughtful and more compassionate than government healthcare?
Well, you know, I would, you know, frame the argument like this. Would you rather live next to a neighbor who you know is very charitable or a government bureaucrat? You know, 9 times out of 10, I really think that you're going to want to live, you know, next door to the person who's very charitable rather than the government bureaucrat. Because at the end of the day, our communities know our stories, and there's a personal connection within communities and charitable organizations that you do not get as soon as you put the barrier of government between people. To the government, you're just a number. To your community and, you know, the common culture, you're a person. And I think that that's a winning argument for the right. When it comes, you know, God forbid I ever got sick and, you know, I didn't have health care. Am I really going to trust the government more than, you know, I'm going to trust, you know, the people in Lone Conservative, you know, to set up like a GoFundMe or like any of my friends to do something like that? I'm going to trust, you know, my friends and my community way more than I'm going to trust the government. And I think that there's actually, you know, whether it's subconscious or, you know, they're not willing to admit it, I really do think that the left believes that that's the case. You know, getting them away from the religion of government will certainly help that, you know, help that sort of formulate within their minds. But I think that the way that the right should, you know, argue this is, like I said, do you trust your community more or do you trust the government bureaucracy more? 9 out of 10 people, I think, really are going to say the people in their community.
Definitely. I think that capitalism has really helped out on this issue because you don't even need your community anymore. There's things like GoFundMe and Kickstarter and all these great places where you can literally have someone tweet out a link and you can get millions of dollars, not millions, but thousands of dollars sent to you. I know Jake Tapper, every time there's an officer who dies or a tragedy or an act of evil that was carried out in Las Vegas like this, he normally finds the verified GoFundMe and he tweets it out. And Jake Tapper has over a million followers right there. Even if 1% of his followers give money, that's still going to be a lot of money. So people say that, oh, people shouldn't have to raise GoFundMe to fight their cancer. I agree, but I mean, that's just life. Life isn't easy. Life isn't fair. And for some people, I mean, they just don't have the money. I'd rather rely on the GoFundMe and, like you said, the charity of people you know. Family first, then your friends, then your church, and then last resort, government. But I mean, when you look at it, the social institutions that our country was founded on, which made us great, not our government system, which is just government at the end of the day. It's the social institutions we had, and with those are breaking down, I think we can both agree that that's not good for America, and it shows in healthcare as an indirect effect. But I think that's where we're going to leave it today. We had a great discussion. I think that we covered a lot of ground. I think you were very well informed on these topics, which made the discussion that much better, because I think everyone who listens can pull away a lot of information and make a lot of conclusions for their own. So a couple things before we sign off. I'm going to give my recommendation. I'm going to do a book or a podcast, and then I'm going to sign you off. You're going to tell us where we can find you. This week's recommendation is Planet Money. It's a podcast from NPR. It's a little left-leaning, but I think it's a very good podcast for people to check out. It focuses on funny stories in the economy, cool little things you don't know, maybe about like bread industry or like a weird tariff. It's something worth checking out. It's twice weekly. It's only about 20 minutes. Something worth listening to. That's Planet Money at NPR. And before you leave, I have two things I want from you. One, do you like pineapple pizza? It's a question I ask all of my guests.
I am from Chicago. Pineapple belongs in a fruit salad if you ever get it within 10 feet of my pizza. I swear to God, when I found out how devout Cassie was to pineapple pizza, almost had to block her. That's just bad news.
You shouldn't have said that. This episode might get deleted now. If people don't hear this episode, it's because this little snippet. But, I mean, I don't know. That's very tough answer on pineapple pizza. That's the strongest no I think I've ever gotten. That was a pretty – wow, that's a – great answer. I agree with you, but wow, that's a tough answer. So that's going to be 5-2. You're my seventh guest. You're the fifth one to come out against pineapple pizza. So it's been good for me, not good for the Loco Industrial Complex, which enjoys pineapple pizza. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. But I'm not going to let you go right now because I need you to tell me where we can find you on the internet. And is there anything you're working on right now that you'd like to share with the listeners?
You know, right now I'm not working on a whole lot other than graduating. I'm always, however, working on very hot takes that I fire off on Twitter at President Gabe. No caps there, no spaces, just at President Gabe. You can follow me there. And like I said, the only thing that I'm really working on is hot takes. And if I can actually plug recommendation in here, we're nearing playoff baseball. National Review, they usually do a great podcast called The Editors. They did a special baseball edition. I don't know how much of a baseball guy you are, Robert, but I'm sure some of our listeners are. We got playoff baseball coming in. They've got an awesome episode just on baseball with actually Dan McLaughlin.
Baseball Crank on Twitter. That's him. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Huge baseball fan. No idea National Review did that. They're one of my favorite places to go. So definitely baseball fans, check that out too, because this episode is two baseball fans coming together. I think that's really good. So thank you for coming on. You can follow us on Twitter at Low Conservative. That is going to be the Low Conservative Twitter. My Twitter is at Real Robert Sasso, all together. And the show's Twitter is at Campus Con Show. Make sure you give all of those a follow. We always produce good content at Low Conservative. It's something that everyone should check out. Go across the sites, look at our articles, look at our other content. Thank you for coming on, Gabriel, and see you guys next week.